Okay.
Daniel chapter 11, this chapter is usually interpreted by denominational mainstream Christians
microphone muted
to be limited to the time of the Maccabees in the scope of its prophecy and the struggles between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that the scope is much more far-reaching than that. And I had this discussion with Eli James about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, when we did Daniel, a Daniel discussion way back in maybe 2010. However, I have not yet had the time to get back to Daniel 11 and study it sufficiently in order to deduce whether or not the prophecy is broader in scope or not. I believe it is, but I can't prove it. I believe it's much broader in scope than simply the period between the Testaments or however these denominational Christians, they usually interpret along those lines, and I don't agree with it. But I haven't had time to formulate an alternate thesis yet, and that would take some time. I'd really have to endeavor a Daniel commentary in order to do that. I'm not like afraid of that. It's just something I haven't had the chance to do yet. I mean, I can only produce so much Bible commentary in 10 years, I guess. So one key factor in this is that in Daniel chapter 11, it basically informs us that this book is sealed until the time of the end. So perhaps maybe, and that comes in Daniel chapter 12, actually, but the context doesn't really break between 11 and 12. And that comes in Daniel chapter 12. And Daniel chapter 12, verse 1 refers to events in Daniel that are prophesied at the very end of Daniel chapter 11, where Michael the prince shall stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people. And that's the resurrection is explained prophesied there. And that's why this chapter, the scope of it has to be far beyond the period of the Maccabees and the intertestamental period. It just has to be. But it's not normally interpreted that way by these so-called denominational theologians and commentators. They try to confine it to the period of the Hellenistic period and the Maccabees and the Ptolemies, and they try to confine it to that, and that's not right. I know that's not right, but I don't have like an alternate thesis yet. I would have to go through, I would have to sit in Daniel 11 and go through every word and study all the Hebrew and the meanings of the terms, make sure it's properly translated, make sure the cases of the nouns and the tenses of the verbs are proper. Right, because it's so many times the King James Version and denominational commentaries will take future tense verbs and translate them into present tense, or present tense verbs and translate them into future tense. I wouldn't trust any of that. I would want to check it all myself. So that would take some time to formulate a thesis on Daniel chapter 1 that offers a viable alternative interpretation of its meaning, which I haven't had the chance to do. So that's all I have to say about that. I hope it made sense.
Daniel 11:1. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I shew thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, and shall return into his own land. But his sons shall be stirred up, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through, then shall he return and be stirred up, even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude. The multitude shall be given into his hand.
Yeah, this is a good stopping point. Around verse 14, 15? No, 11. Okay.
Yep.
That's fine. I was looking around while you were reading, but that's all right. Okay. In the first year of Darius the Mede, and this is actually, I believe it might be out of time, because I really believe that Darius the Mede here is a reference to a title referring to Cyrus, the king of Persia, who was considered a Mede in the sense that his mother was a princess of the Medes, and that this vision should actually precede chapter 10. Chapters 11 and 12 should precede chapter 10, in my opinion. So, if this is Cyrus, the king of Persia, this Darius the Mede, if it's a title for him, then this prophecy is very profound. I call it the prophecy of four kings, because Cambyses, his son, was his successor. And then someone the Greeks called Pseudo-Smerdis, I forget his Persian name, Pseudo-Smerdis was his son's successor, and Pseudo-Smerdis was actually a usurper who was deposed after 9 months by Darius Hystaspes, and they would be the three kings. There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of the Greeks. And that word is Yavanna, by the way, the Ionians. But that was the typical Persian word for the Greeks, even though there were other tribes that were not Ionians. The Ionians were the notable tribe of Greeks. Well, that fourth king would be Xerxes, and it was actually Xerxes who did lead the Persian armies into Greece. Like 1.8 million soldiers and sailors into Greece, 2,500 ships. I forget the precise numbers given by Herodotus, but I'm pretty sure it was around 2,500 ships and 1.8 million men was Herodotus's version of the size of Xerxes's army. A lot of mainstream historians doubt that number, but I really don't doubt that number. It's very possible that Persia was able to raise that many men. And in fact, if you really study the correct chronology of Nehemiah and Ezra, Nehemiah was recalled to Babylon. He was recalled to the Persians in 490 BC, and that ended his being governor of Jerusalem. And he was recalled because of the Battle of Marathon, because the Persians suffered a big victory at Marathon. And they were probably calling in their governors and their military men to regroup. That's my opinion of that. And Ezra didn't come along to start rebuilding, to finish rebuilding Jerusalem until like 458, 457 BC. So that gap in time is because of the preparations that were taken over a 10-year period to launch the war against the Greeks. And after the loss at Marathon, where the Persians lost 40,000 troops, it took them 10 years to mount the offensive of Xerxes against the Greeks. It took them 3 years to lose. And then from the time that they lost, it's probably about another 20 years until the time of Ezra before they actually started venturing to undertake great public works again. So that's what accounts for that long lapse of space between Nehemiah and Ezra. And the mainstream commentators and denominational commentators don't even get that right, because they put Ezra before Nehemiah, and the book of Nehemiah itself proves that that is wrong. So this prophecy, this four kings, can be told, and it's very revealing, because it's a direct prophecy that from the time of Cyrus, that there is going to be four kings in Persia. The fourth one will raise a war against the Greeks, and that was Xerxes, without a doubt. Out of that, beyond that, this prophecy becomes very obscure in many aspects, and it becomes very difficult to interpret. And it might be said that the battle between the king of the south and the king of the north was initially between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, but the denominational commentators like to end it by the Roman period, and I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. I think it is much more broad in scope. But as I said, I haven't done the study necessary to develop an alternative thesis yet, even though I have an alternative understanding.
And so would Daniel chapter 10 be the final chapter of Daniel, in your opinion, Bill?
Yes, because I believe this should follow Daniel chapter 10. Unless Darius the Mede refers to another person who lived during the time of Cyrus, but I can't prove that. Some people claim that this Darius the Mede was a governor of Babylon or some other official, but I can't prove that. But Darius is simply a title. And Cyrus was considered to be a Mede, at least quite often. His father was a Persian, but his mother was a Mede. He was raised in the household of the Medes. But there's alternative accounts of Cyrus's youth, because some say that he was, Herodotus describes him as being exposed as a baby by his father, by his mother's father, King Astyages of the king of the Medes. And that when he was raised up, he actually supplanted him. But he was raised by strangers in Media because he was exposed. Now, that's Herodotus' account. I have not read the account of Darius in a work of Xenophon's called the Cyrenicus, but I do understand that it's a completely different account that doesn't have him exposed as a youth.
I'll continue with verse 12.
Well, let me say that the Ptolemies, right? That there's a description here of this king's daughter of the south. And a lot of people, of course, automatically refer to that as Cleopatra. But she had never had a significant victory over the Seleucids. Not that I know of. I mean, I don't know the entire history of the wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. The Ptolemies did have some small victories, But they never had a significant victory over the Seleucids. Not that endured or that was any great victory that I'm aware of. There were actually said to be 6 wars between the Seleucid Empire and the Empire of the Ptolemy to the south. I could go through them, but only from superficial sources. I don't know if it's really fitting to do that. So I'd rather not. I'd rather not right now. Evidently, the Ptolemies were successful in the first Syrian war. After that, they didn't do so well. But that was Ptolemy that won that war and not any of his daughters. So Antiochus married Ptolemy, one of Ptolemy's daughters. But then there were 4 more Syrian wars after that, so that didn't create any kind of peaceful alliance. Evidently, the Ptolemies were successful in the 3rd war. They held on to much of their success in the 4th war, and then it was all downhill from there. But those history, those wars, I honestly don't know much about. I've read them in Diodorus Siculus long ago, but I don't remember much about them. They weren't that significant to me. The outcome was more significant. But they were all over a short period of time of about 100 years. From 274 BC to 170 BC, 168 BC. Shortly after 168 BC was the revolt of the Maccabees in Jerusalem. And Egypt must have declined to the point where they couldn't take advantage of that revolt because Jerusalem managed to stay independent of both Syria and Egypt from that time until the coming of the Romans. And that period of history I know a lot more about. So was there a marriage arrangement as we see in verse 6 here? Yes, there was. But that doesn't mean that the scope of this prophecy is limited to the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. There's not even mention of Cleopatra II. Let's see what it says about Cleopatra II. The 6th Syrian War. Cleopatra I died in 176 BC. Her oldest son, Ptolemy Philometor, was still only 10 years old. Ptolemy VI was married to his sister, Cleopatra II, and she was declared a co-ruler. So she led the 6th Syrian War, but she was a loser. They didn't have any great victory, as this describes. So I would say that it's not speaking of her. in verse 6. I don't know. I would have to study Daniel and study these wars a little better. But I never agreed that the scope of this chapter should be limited to those wars. And if it's speaking of her in verse 6, that's fine. But that's the end of these wars. And this goes a lot further than that. But after Cleopatra II, the Ptolemies never made any more gains in the north, in Syria. They were done. They were done in Syria. And the famous Cleopatra that we know from the time of Mark Antony, she's like the eighth or ninth Cleopatra, I think. And there were a bunch of them that married their own brother in order to maintain power. As we just saw with Cleopatra II, she was married to her brother, which is just crazy, but that's what the Macedonians were doing.
Well, Clark is mentioning Berenice, daughter of Ptolemy. Philadelphus, king of Egypt, was married to Antiochus Theos, king of Syria. These two sovereigns had a bloody war for some years, and they agreed to terminate it by the above marriage.
Right, but Berenice didn't take captives back to Egypt, as we see in verse 6, right? Or maybe it's verse 7. No, verse 8. But that's a branch out of her roots. That's a branch out of one of the roots of this victorious king's daughter of the south. But this victorious king's daughter of the south doesn't really describe any of the Ptolemies. Because only Cleopatra II was a ruler during the time of these wars, and that wasn't until the last of them, and she wasn't a victor.
Yes, that's very obscure.
Yes, it's obscure. It doesn't really describe Cleopatra II at all. And if it describes, it can't describe Berenice because she was married to the Seleucids. She was married to the king of the north, right? If it's describing the Seleucids as the king of the north. Which I don't doubt because of the procession, the way it's down to Xerxes. And then it speaks about in the end of years in verse 6. Now in verse 4, okay, we get Xerxes in the war against Persia in verse 2. And then it says, a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule a great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven. And that's definitely Alexander the Great, right? There's no doubt it's Alexander the Great, who's actually the subject of another prophecy earlier in Daniel. So the prophecy of the goat and the ram. So then that was in Daniel chapter 10, I believe. And the king of the south shall be strong. And the Ptolemies were initially powerful. And one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and shall have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Well, the dominion of the Ptolemies was never really that great. It was never anywhere close to the dominion of Alexander himself. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm. And in the end of years, right? Well, okay, Alexander died around 330 BC. And for a very short time, Alexander's wife, who had his newborn son that Alexander never laid eyes on. Okay, Alexander's wife was pregnant and Alexander went to Babylon and died there and never saw his son get born. and she has the son, and there's a caretaker, if you will, that's appointed over the kingdom, and the son is supposed to become the king, and they're killed. They're poisoned. They're murdered, assassinated, however you want to explain it. And four of Alexander's generals decided to divide the kingdom among themselves. And I don't remember exactly how long a time that took, but it was years. It was measured in years. It may have been 10 years or 20 years. I don't remember. It wasn't 20 years because I don't think the boy ever, he barely saw his teens from what I remember. So it was over 10 years before his kingdom was divided in four pieces, when those four generals divvied it up, and one got Greece and one got Thrace roughly, and one got Syria and one got Egypt. And that's what set up this war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. But this war didn't start in the end of years. This war started the First Syrian War, 60 years after Alexander died. Not quite 60 years, really like 54 years, 56 years after Alexander died, this war began. And these wars were over within 160 years after Alexander's death. So does that qualify as the end of years? If that's how you want to interpret that, but at the end of the years, the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of his arm, neither shall she stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up. And they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times. But out of a branch of her root shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against him, and shall prevail. Well, the first female ruler in the Syrian wars with the Ptolemies is Cleopatra II in the last of those wars, and she was a failure. But after that, no Egyptian ruler conquered anything in Syria. It didn't happen. It never happened. Until Islam. But that wasn't a woman. I mean, he may as well have been, I know, but that wasn't a woman. And the Islamic forces weren't led by a woman. So this has to be a much greater scope here. I don't agree that this has anything to do with the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. I think it transcends that. But I don't have an alternate thesis.
All right, shall I read verse 12 then, Bill? If anyone else doesn't have a question.
Or a better idea.
Yeah, does someone else have an alternative thesis? I'll read verse 12. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many thousands, but he shall not be strengthened by it. The king of the north shall return, and he shall set forth a multitude greater than the former. And he shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision. But they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found.
User
then shall
channel.
Stand up in the estate a raiser User of taxes in the glory down. Of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with the small people. He shall enter peaceably, even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his father's fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and the spoil and the riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him, yea. They that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed.
The end of verse 27.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to go back to like verse 12, right? I mean, he's taking away the multitude. That's the multitude that supposedly this king of the south brings into the south, right? And when he has taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. And after any woman ever ruled Egypt, this never happened. After Cleopatra II, this never happened at all, any time in history. The only war that Egypt was involved in again was the civil war between Octavian and Mark Antony, which ended with Octavian's victory at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. And from that point on, Egypt became a province of Rome. In 30 BC, Egypt became a province of Rome. So this doesn't describe that period, not at all. So this king of the south simply can't be have anything to do with Ptolemaic Egypt at this time. It can't. That's why I don't accept this. For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than former, and shall come with after certain years. Well, we're already in the end of years, and this is after more certain years, with a great army and much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fail. Well, yeah, we know who the robbers of thy people are, but the Syrians never conquered Egypt. They never conquered Egypt itself, the Seleucids. Only the Romans conquered Egypt, but that didn't happen until 30 BC, 31 BC, Battle of Actium. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mountain, take the most fenced cities. The Seleucids never did that. The Romans just took all of Egypt because Mark Antony and Cleopatra were defeated at Actium. But Actium wasn't even in Egypt. Actium is in, I think it's in Macedonia or Pannonia or something like that. It's in Europe, right? So this doesn't describe anything to do with the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. This is way beyond that. It must transcend that. And it must transcend it greatly. I just don't have an alternate thesis. I'm sorry. Then, after taking Egypt, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of the whole kingdom. And then in verse 18, after this, he shall turn his face under the isles. Well, the Romans had already taken all of the isles of the Mediterranean long before the Battle of Actium, long before they took Egypt. And they had already invaded Britain and failed 10, 12 years before they took Egypt, Julius Caesar. But they had already controlled Gaul and Iberia by the time they controlled Egypt, by the time Egypt became a province. So this doesn't even match Roman history. It really doesn't describe Roman history either. I kind of think that it transcends all of that. And it's really speaking about the wars between the popes and the Muslims, or the victories that Islam had over the kings of the north, which would be personified by the popes, in my opinion. And I've always wanted to see, to really investigate that, to see if that holds up. But I haven't had the time to do that yet.
Well, there's an interesting character at verse 21, a guy who obtains the kingdom by flatteries. I mean, I don't know who that could be.
That could be a lot of different popes or kings in Europe, probably.
Yeah, bribery or something. I don't...
Yeah. Or maybe a banker.
Yeah.
a bunch of bankers.
And then verse 22. Oh, sorry, Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say in verse 22, what's this Prince of the Covenant?
Yeah. And there's a flood.
I don't know. Is it a reference
there to
Christ? We would think Christ, right? But yeah, not in this context. Is it a Holy Roman Emperor? Is it a reference to Christ? Who is this? I don't know.
Could it be?
But that is why I would want to examine every Hebrew word, right? Before I even started to make an interpretation.
Could it be a little earlier and be Constantine the Great?
Would he be the Prince of the Covenant?
Well,
it was damn pagan.
I know, but
he only went Christian because it was politically expedient.
Yeah, I just don't know if this is really calling him the Prince of the Covenant in a positive way, because he's the creator of the Catholic Church, really, to some degree, right?
Yeah, but was that really a good thing?
No, but I don't know that
I don't think it was. It imperialized Christianity in the end.
Yeah, it was terrible. But I mean, I just don't know that this is a compliment. It's almost like sarcastic.
Well, it's definitely leader, ruler, captain, or prince, the word Nagid of the covenant, Bereith. But that could be referring to a common alliance of men.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the new covenant or the old covenant.
Yeah.
It's a covenant, a common alliance of men that they had some agreement, and he was the prince that made it, or the ruler that made it, and he broke it.
But
I would want to examine the entire context in every Hebrew word before I made an interpretation.
Well, we're about to read verse 28, and it has a holy covenant there. So maybe there's a holy covenant and a normal covenant, you know, like maybe it's been set in contrast to the normal covenant, the Prince of the Covenant. Because why has it got a holy covenant in verse 28?
Yeah, it makes more sense to me, what you're saying. It's just a covenant between rulers, I would think. I mean, the previous to 28, of course.
His heart shall be against the holy covenant.
Yeah. Which kind of goes with what you said about Constantine, right? Because we all know that he wasn't an actual Christian.
This is one of the most obscure passages of the Bible I can think of.
It is, but it's also sealed. It is no context break. We'll see that there's no break in the context into chapter 12. And this is sealed until the time of the end. And if it's not the time to understand it, we're just not going to understand it. I don't care how much I or any one of us beat our heads against the wall.
That's what it feels like.
But I have to reject the denominational interpretation. It's just wrong.
Oh, I'll keep reading then. From verse 28.
Sure.
Then shall he... Oh, you got something to say?
User entered your channel.
I said sure.
Bob Noble has something to say. Right. Then shall he return into his own, to his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the later. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, a God whom his fathers knew not, shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be out his steps. But the tidings of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and to utterly make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So at verse 35, and to make them white, is that racial, Bill?
No.
Yeah, I know, I was just kidding.
Right. Nobody is made white. You are. Yeah. No, that's that in our trials, We learn to be purged of our sins, I believe, is what that means. That word white is Laban. It's definitely white. And some of them understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white. Even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. It's speaking about the trials of this world and how you learn not to sin because you learn the consequences of sin. That's how I read that.
There's a lot of talk about the Holy Covenant at the first parts I was reading.
Microphone
indignation against the he shall even return, have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant.
Right, and I believe that this is very transcendental in scope, and even if I can't tie it to particular events, except that this abomination of desolation
user
and taking
channel.
Away the daily sacrifice, I explained that earlier in the prophecy of the little horn that I believe is Muhammad, and Daniel chapter 8. And it'll be awfully hard to convince me otherwise, but that abomination of desolation is what I believe that Dome of the Rock represents, because they built it on what they believe was the Temple Mount, and they seek to replace Yahweh with Allah, with their God. And just because there's places here that capitalize the word God, that doesn't mean that it's a reference to Yahweh. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. He does marvelous things against the God of gods and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. I would probably want to put that with a small g. But in his estate, he shall honor the God of forces and the God whom his fathers knew not. I would want to put that with a small g, thinking that this probably refers to his pagan gods. And that could describe Allah, but not necessarily.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Verse 39. So it's talking about this guy actually worshiping one strange god, it seems. So Constantine worshiped Sol Invictus, that sun god, basically the sun. But look at the end of 39, and shall divide the land. Constantine was the one in the year 330 who divided the Eastern and Western Roman Empire.
Yes. Yeah, I would want more data to match this up with Constantine. I would.
You know that thing that they hold up in front of the Pope? It looks like the sun. It's like a golden plaque, and it's like, you know, on a rod.
Yeah, it's just friggin' evil Roman paganism. I understand that.
Yeah, and it's probably came from Constantine, because he was like, I'm going to put my God symbol in this thing, you know?
Yeah, you know, the entire Roman priesthood was transferred into Christianity, right? The entire pagan priesthood in the 3rd and 4th centuries became Christian priests. But before the time of Eusebius, I can't find the term Christian priest or the word priest in reference to being a Christian priest in any of the ancient church fathers, not in one of them until the time of Eusebius. And I've looked. I've searched it in a computer database on the Ante-Nicene Fathers, which are the church writers before the Council of Nicaea. I can't find the term Christian priest. The only priests I find in any of those writings, Tertullian, Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Clement of Rome, on and on. The only priest I find in any of those writings are either pagan references to pagan priests that are explicit or references to Levites that are explicit, period. There ain't no Christian priest until Eusebius. And Eusebius was a friend and a contemporary with Constantine.
Yeah, you know, that's a good thing. I tried bringing up once with an Orthodox Christian, but it just doesn't work. They don't care and they don't believe you.
Yeah, they don't believe it. They don't care, but they don't want to do the research for themselves. They just want to cling to their false paradigm.
Yeah, because it's easy and it makes them, you know, feel warm and fuzzy.
Right. Well, I've actually went through the Ante-Nicene Fathers checking every fucking occurrence of the word priest. So I know that I'm right. And that probably, took an entire morning at least. I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. 4:30, Mark says that the ships of Chittim are the Romans, and they're coming to besiege Alexandria. Now that, I don't know. Does that seem to make sense to you, Bill?
Well, no, because I mean, Egypt was pretty much done in Actium when Mark Antony and Cleopatra was defeated there.
He then goes on to say that the Romans opposed the Holy Covenant because they were mean to Jewish people. Yeah, so they don't know.
Yeah, Jews didn't lose the Battle of Actium. It was a civil war among Romans. And Mark Antony allied himself with Cleopatra. And Octavian was not Augustus yet, right? He was only part of a triumvirate. And he prevailed in the civil war with Antony. I think the third ruler was Cassius. I'm not positive. But Antony prevailed. I mean, Octavian prevailed. And after that, he became Augustus. That's when he became Augustus, when he became the emperor and took the title Augustus and did away with the triumvirate and assumed rule by himself. That created the empire, the Battle of Actium.
Apparently, Gesenius claims that the Chittim are the Cyprians, because I'm just trying to look at who the Chittim came against, and because that's the person
originally. Originally, the Chittim are the Cyprians, and this is Daniel. So I would think that where he wrote Chittim, he meant the Phoenicians of Cyprus, who were great mariners and who were often mercenaries for other rulers because Tyre was gone. I would not take this to read Chittim here the way that the Judeans used the term Chittim 400 years after Daniel. 400 years after Daniel, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls referred to the Romans as the Chittim. But that's wrong. I don't think Daniel would do that. But I wouldn't interpret this in that manner. And Chittim in Daniel's time is a reference to Cyprus. However, and part of Cyprus was also Alishaya, but Chittim was a prominent city in Cyprus, and it was settled by Japhethites of the sons of Javan. So the Chittim were basically Greeks of Cyprus early on, but Phoenicians settled there in large numbers and eclipsed the previous Ionian inhabitants. And they did that by the 8th, 9th century BC, maybe before that. In the golden age of Tyre, probably before that. But no later in the 9th century, the same century Carthage was founded. So I would think Daniel used Chittim in a more original sense to mean Cyprus, yes.
Yeah, my new King James has Cyprus on verse 30.
Yeah. In a slightly wider sense, it could mean Greeks, but or be a reference to a subsection of Greeks, which would be true by Daniel's time. But no, it doesn't mean the Romans ever. That's a Jewish interpretation. But it started in Judea in the first century BC, is the earliest I've ever seen it. It's in the War Scroll. Kittim is a reference to Rome. And it's an assumption, and it's a wrong assumption on the part of the Judeans of the first century BC.
Microphone muted.
And so the abomination that makes the desolate is basically just Islam.
Yeah, you know what? That's what I've always thought. And that's because of other references in Daniel to an abomination that makes desolate, or the abomination of desolation. And Islam, I think, can be described in both ways. So, I'm sorry, I'm still looking for this passage.
Well, it's like Islam changed that area forever and made it all desolate and destroyed, right, like the covenant of the people. And
I don't think Islam made it desolate. I think they made the desolation abominable.
Well, once that happens, we can't go back. You know, once that land's destroyed, us white people can't go back there. So it's like seals the desolation.
Yeah. Daniel 11 and in Daniel 12, it appears as the abomination that maketh desolate. Well, which might be true, but Christ in Matthew and Mark said, "Ye shall see the abomination of desolation," spoken of by Daniel. So I can read the Greek there. It's definitely abomination of desolation, not abomination which makes desolate. Not really. It would be a stretch of the Greek grammar, I think, to translate it in that manner, because desolation is in the genitive case. And because it's genitive, it's of desolation, the abomination of desolation. And I think that Islam fulfilled both roles, but Christ told the Jews, "Your house will be left to you desolate." That's what he told the Judeans in the time of his ministry. "Your house will be left to you desolate." And the Romans came and destroyed the city and scraped it clean. So the Dome of the Rock, is an abomination set in a place that's supposed to be desolate. So to me, it's an abomination of desolation, which is exactly what Christ said in Matthew 24 and Mark 13. That's exactly what he said. So it may be interpreted in either way. But I would want to study the grammar of Daniel before I made a definitive decision.
Hey, Bill, you just said something that got me triggered, my simple mind. Hey, the abomination that makes desolate that Christ spoke of in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, can we have an early fulfillment of 70 AD in one scope?
Huh?
When Christ told them to remember what Daniel said, the abomination that makes desolate, in Matthew 24, Luke 21, and Mark 13, is there an early fulfillment during the Jewish war?
No, that was just the desolation that Christ had promised.
Just okay.
That made the place desolate. But then when the Dome of the Rock was set there, that made the desolation abominable.
I got it. Yes, I see it now. Thanks.
That's why I consider that to be the abomination of desolation. because Christ promised that that place would be left desolate, and they made it abominable. They put this abomination there in the middle of what he said would be desolate. And of course, it's still desolate, but they think it's God.
Right, but Bill, in the near future, we're not going to be going back to that place, are we? I mean, the prophecy of that place is finished regarding us.
Turning the glass, I don't think.
Okay, I just don't want it to. I don't want it to see. I don't want to see the sandbox arise again. In other words, I just soon see it completely nuked off the face of the earth.
Wherever the non-whites go, they just create desolations.
The only verse that talks about the sandbox today is the opening verses of
Malachi. Okay.
Or Hosea, I'm fucking retarded now. I'm sorry.
It's in Malachi, isn't it?
The opening
verse. They will return.
Malachi, yeah. I got it, but wait. After a few guesses. Yeah, the opening verse is in Malachi. Talks about the Jews, Edom, returning to rebuild the desolate places. There you have it. But while they're rebuilding the desolate places, that abomination is still there. We will return and build the desolate places. Which is another passage that ties that desolation to Jerusalem.
Noble wants to know if at verse 37 where it says, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers nor the desire of women, could that be the Pope since they're celibate? Was supposed that they claim to be celibate?
Yeah, well, they're not really celibate, but they don't desire women. They desire little boys. Just my opinion.
Yeah, disgusting.
Yeah.
But could that be the, because they don't desire, could that be the popery, you reckon?
Well, it could be. And I've already went back when I was doing this with Eli in 2012 or 2010, I think. I was strongly leaning towards interpreting this as the struggles between the popes of the Catholic Church and Islam. I'm not settled on that yet, but that's what I was leaning towards at that time. I would just need a long study on it in order to determine, to even know if I could make a determination. Like Noble said, this seems to be laying out like things point by point, exactly what's going to happen, yet we can't understand it.
Yeah, it's like it's breaking it down for us, and we still don't get it.
Hey, Bill, what about verse 45 when he says, I'll set my tents of this palace between the seas? What seas is he talking about, do you think? The Mediterranean, the Atlantic?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't know until, I mean, this seems to be, if we interpret this along the lines of Micah and other prophecies, it could be here. But I wouldn't even want to make that call, because how could I interpret the end before I interpret the beginning?
Hey, Bill, can I just make one more point about my Constantine theory? So in verse 45, Constantinople is in between the two seas there.
And it says, is.
He shall plant the tabernacle. That Hagia Sophia is basically in the tip of one of those hills, but in the middle, kind of.
It's on the isthmus?
I believe so. I mean, it's like seven hills, Constantinople, that are in between, you know, the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. But
how come so many cities are seven hills? What the fuck's up with that?
I don't know.
Well, Rome's on seven hills. Jerusalem's on seven hills. I mean, come on. I live in a swamp. Yeah, Ayasofya Kami. Yeah, it's basically on a peninsula. Sticking out there. But Constantine didn't build that.
Yeah, I know he didn't build it, but I think
Justinian did.
Yeah.
I'm sure Justinian did.
Yeah, but I think there was a forerunner to it on that spot. Let me see if I can find it. I don't know if it really matters.
Obvious did a book on buildings describing all the buildings of Justinian. I'm pretty sure that was one of them. I had to go look. It's been a long time since I read it.
Okay. I don't know. I can't.
It's not important. Polybius described the Hagia Sophia in 537. I just looked it up real quick.
Yeah, but I'm looking for what there was a different place there before, and they rebuilt over it, I believe. But I just don't remember I don't know how to look it up because I don't remember what it's called.
The emperor, thinking not of cost of any kind, pressed on the work and collected together workmen from every land. Anthemius of Tralles, the most skilled in the builder's art, not only of his own, but of all former times, carried forward the king's zealous intention, organized the labors of workmen, and prepared models of the future construction. Associated with him was another architect named Isidorus, a Milesian by birth, Miletus, a man of intelligence and worthy to carry out the plans of the emperor Justinian.
Okay, I found it. The structure originally erected on the site of the Hagia Sophia was a Christian cathedral called the Magala Ecclesia, which was commissioned by Constantine the Great. Prior to that, the site had been the home to a pagan temple.
Okay.
So I guess they crushed that thing. And you know what? I don't know if this picture is accurate. But the picture of the pagan temple looks like the Hagia Sophia. It just looks like an upgraded version. Hagia Sophia looks like an upgraded version of this thing they had.
Well, Procopius describes this building, but he doesn't describe any previous structure, right? But maybe it's just giving Justinian too much credit.
Yeah, I don't know. That word, Megala Ecclesia, it meant the grand church.
Yeah. This isn't the entire account, though. I mean, I got the book on my shelf, but I'm going to be too damn lazy to get up and get it and look it up. But this is off a site, palaceweb.com. That's sort of a Greek name, right? Palace Athena. P-A-L-L-A-S. The guy that made this website is an icon painter, a Russian historian, and an Austin web designer. Formerly of Seattle, Washington, and now living in Austin, Texas. So he's one of those people that escaped the liberal West to go ruin the Midwest. He paints icons, so he's an idolater.
Yeah, I know a guy who paints icons. Haven't seen him for 20 years, but
they love their icons.
Yeah, like they get mad if you don't kiss it, you know? Like
oh wow. Yeah. Smash it before I kiss it.
Yeah.
Kissing his fucking icon. Shove it up your ass.
Yeah, it's pathetic.
Yeah.
You know, verse 36, Little Hat says, he will speak marvelous things against God, or something like that.
Yeah, and that kind of sounds like either Little Horn, right? 7 and 8. Daniel 7 and Daniel chapter 8.
And is that part in Revelation speaking of the Pope? So I'm reading Revelation 13.
Great words against the Most High, right? Speaking of the Pope. Nor the desire of woman. That definitely sounds like a Catholic priest to me.
User disconnected from your channel.
You won't do chapter 12 because it's pretty short.
It's a 3-hour discussion. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars for ever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book. Even to the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth for ever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the end, till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand. But the wise shall understand, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,335 days. But go thou thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. This basically just confirms everything you said, Bill, because there wouldn't have been chapter breaks in the Old Testament originally, and right. This shows that everything transcends.
Right.
You know, this is the future time.
It must transcend it. You're running right into the standing up of Michael the Great Prince and this great horrible time and the resurrection, and that didn't happen at the end of the struggles between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. It just didn't, not the way it's described here. And it has to include the setting up of the abomination of desolation. Yet, you know, Jerusalem was made desolate according to the prophet Daniel and according to the words of Christ. Daniel in chapter 9, right, in a separate prophecy of the Messiah, the 70 weeks, Jerusalem was destined to be desolate. And the words of Christ said it would be made desolate, your house would be left to you desolate. Well, when was the abomination of desolation set up? Before the end of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, they were just about at their end at the time of Christ. There were no more Ptolemies ruling Egypt at the time of Christ. So what's up with that? I mean, it just doesn't hold up. The mainstream interpretations of Daniel chapter 11 do not hold up. They're just kidding themselves. And it has to transcend that. And it has to cover all time up until the time of the end, and described here in Daniel chapter 12. But we see in verse 4 that the words are sealed. Shut up the words and seal the book. Now, the revelation opens seals, right? It's not sealed. So we can interpret the revelation. And I have a much easier time interpreting the revelation than I do Daniel chapter 11. That's just the way it is.
Now, verse 8, Daniel says, "And I heard, but I understood not."
Right.
I don't know if he's referring to everything we've described, but I mean, if he didn't understand it.
Well, I think he's referring to what it says in chapter verse 7 about the 3.5 times and the scattering of the power of the holy people, which is basically what we're suffering now.
Yeah. And then we've got the made white bit again. Many shall be purified and made white, which was talked about in the last chapter. And none of the wicked shall understand. Well, in John, it says the wicked, you know, darkness comprehendeth not.
Right.
So that might be the gospel of, that's the gospel of Christ. Many shall be purified and made white.
Right.
And then none of the wicked shall understand because of their racial character. Hey, Bill, this is definitely the end times.
I got a question. 12 is out of order, right? Chapter 12?
I think that chapter 10 belongs after 12. That's my opinion.
Okay, because I was thinking it kind of goes with the end of 10.
I mean, that's possible. But I'm just going by the years in the first year of Cyrus, in the third year of Cyrus, in the first year of Darius, right? Well, which that Darius and Cyrus, they're both titles. So go on.
Well, at the end of 10, it doesn't seem like the prophecy is ended, but just beginning. Well, not really beginning, but it's definitely doesn't seem like it's ended in verse 21. And if you just skip 11 and go to 12, it kind of matches because Michael's mentioned at the end of 10. He's mentioned at 12:1.
Yeah, Michael.
And
yeah.
It looks like the prophecy is being told, and then at the end he tells him to go thy way.
I would sort of agree with that if but then I can't identify who this Darius of the Mede is, right? I can't identify who Darius of the Mede is. But then Cyrus, we would still be in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, and Darius the Mede would not be the king of Persia. He couldn't be, because Cyrus would still have to be the king of Persia, right? Cyrus being Cyrus the Great, who must have been, I would bet that Daniel had to be
user entered your channel
dead by the time that Cyrus was dead. Daniel is pretty old here, right? If this is the third year of Cyrus the Great, Daniel's got to be close to 80 years old, because he was taken captive as a youth, as a young man, or possibly an adolescent teen, by Nebuchadnezzar in 604, 605 BC. So how long can he live? If he was 16, say, when he was in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, his first experiences, if he was 16, then when Cyrus conquers Babylon in 539 BC, that makes Daniel to be like almost 80 years old, man. How long can he live, right? So I don't have Daniel living long after Cyrus conquers Babylon. I just don't, because Daniel has to be a pretty old man by then. So, but I will show thee the last verse of verse 10, but I will show thee that which is noted in the scripture of the truth. And there is none that holdeth with me in these things, but Michael, your prince. And then it says that this language is weird. Also, I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. Maybe that also should be a then, right? I would want to study the grammar. I would want to study the Hebrew. Maybe that also could be a then. And be written as a response to what Daniel heard in verse 21. And that's a possibility, right? The chapter divisions don't do us any fucking justice. They never do. Some of the chapter divisions are just terrible. So, And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. And that would feed right into the coming of the prince of the Greeks, must be Alexander the Great, because no Greek invaded Persia until Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Xenophon was in Persia with 10,000 men 7 years before Alexander the Great, but Xenophon was functioning as a mercenary for one of the Persian nobility. Right? So he's not invading. No Greek invaded Persia until Alexander the Great. And that's exactly what is being explained with these four kings of Persia, this prophecy to four kings in the opening verses of Daniel 11. So I would agree with that. But that's a strong possibility. But in that manner, the king or whoever this Darius the Mede is in Daniel 11:1 cannot be Cyrus.
Yeah,
because it's his first year, and we're already in the third year of Cyrus, right? In the beginning of Daniel 10. So Darius the Mede must refer to somebody else that I don't know who it is.
Well, it could, because the name Darius just means to maintain possessions well. It's like a
title. Just means a ruler or a governor. Yeah. It's used of governors. It's used of kings.
Yeah. Kind of like Stefan was used by the Greeks, right? Like in the Middle Ages, right? So
it's a title. That's all it is.
Yeah.
So anyway, that is a strong possibility. Yes, I would agree. Because the context doesn't really break. But there's no way that Daniel 11, from everything we've seen tonight, can possibly be limited to the struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And nothing the Ptolemies did really is described by that, in the order in which those events are described.
Yeah, like the marriage.
It's a very superficial interpretation.
After the part about the marriage between the queen in the south and the king of the north, I mean, that apparently happened in the year 223 BC. So when it mentions at the end of, and in those, I can't remember what it was, but the end of the years, it's basically like, I don't know, 90 years or 100 years. So, I mean, other than that, after that, yeah, it doesn't seem to be, I don't know. I don't know enough about the history of that war either, but it seems to be right until that marriage.
Yeah, but there was no female ruler until Cleopatra II. And she didn't really make any accomplishments. And she did nothing like this female ruler is said to do.
Yeah, this one that, I don't know what verse it is now. I'm going back. I think she was just a princess though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I don't think she was actually queen, but a ruling queen. But
well, she ruled, and Cleopatra II ruled while her brother was coming of age, right? He was very young when his father died.
But that's not the one. It wasn't. Was Cleopatra II the one in 223 BC?
No, she was 50 years later.
Right. I'm talking about the verse that talks about the marriage.
That's Berenice.
Yeah, between the north and the south. And I don't know if we even know her name.
I think it's Berenice. We discussed her before.
Okay.
And she was married off to a Seleucid. But she was married to a Seleucid. She didn't accomplish those things that this king's daughter of the south is described as doing in Daniel. She didn't do any of that.
Female accomplishment has been like dismissed throughout history.
Yeah.
That's why we have feminism to, you know, find all their female accomplishments that were hidden. And this might be one of them.
Yeah. We had Jews for that. Maybe it was the Little Mermaid and she took over the whole world. No. And she was a nigger. Netflix edition. Well, I don't know if y'all got anything to say about anything else to say about Daniel. The words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. Verse 9 repeats basically verse 4. And I believe those from the time that Dome of the Rock is set up, possibly, that's pretty specific time periods there that something big is supposed to happen, but.
Okay, one last thing. So yeah, 11:6. All what I'm referring to is, it's just saying that she was a daughter of the king. She shall not retain power. And then it talks about a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate. So I'm not thinking that this is, I'm just saying that after this, right, the rest of 11, like you said, that could be referring to transcending to something else.
I think it has to.
Which verse, David?
In 6, 11:6, right? That's when it's mentioned. And you can look that up historically. They married in 223 BC. User disconnected from your channel. Right? But after that, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in this time frame, but I don't know that we can pinpoint, like Bill said, any of this other stuff to be immediately following that or within the 100 or 200 years after that until close to the end. And even then, it's up in the air.
Hey, David?
Yeah.
So the Ptolemies were the south and the Seleucids were the north, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, and you're saying Bill wants to make a chapter break into where we go from what we know into no man's land, basically starting with verse 7.
No, I'm not saying what Bill wants to do. I'm just mentioning that we have, like, historically, we can trace up to chapter 6 pretty easily.
You mean up to verse 6?
Up to verse 6. And after that, it becomes ambiguous, and we really can't trace it. And nothing that happened between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids is really described by it.
Right.
Okay. Bill, I got an off-the-cuff question just for shits and giggles. If you were to put on your conservative Christian hat for a second, where would you put the split, let's say from verses 38 through 45, where would you put the split where the Greek Empire is being overtaken and the Roman Empire's kicking in, if you did?
There's no certainty that any of this describes Rome or the Greek Empire.
Okay, but you do understand my question I'm asking, right?
Yeah, but this doesn't describe Rome, the Roman Empire and its relationship to the Greek Empire. It doesn't describe that.
Okay.
And if the Seleucids are the king of the north, are the kings of the north, how could the Romans suddenly become the kings of the north? Because they're a little further north. They're not really further north. They're only further west.
I understand that. I got that.
I think all the denominational interpretations are bullshit, and they should be all thrown away, and it's better to start from scratch.
By the way, just
the book is sealed, and I don't think it's going to be revealed to us. I don't know. Maybe someday it will.
Let me know when you want me to cut the recording.
Well, I'm finished here this evening. I mean, I think we've covered everything that we should.
Okay.